Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, we are looking through verses 14 to 32, but we'll begin with the key sentence of the passage, Jesus' words in Mark 9, verse 19, O unbelieving generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Disbelief, wrote Os Guinness, has many faces. We would agree with him. You can recognize disbelief in crude materialism, in scientism, in pantheism and the worship of nature, in the pursuit of fame and success that have become a sort of modern holy grail, and in the current psychic epidemics that rampage around our world. The sects, the false spiritualities that some might call misbelief, but they too should be grouped along with every other form of disbelief that does not have Jesus Christ at the center. We're talking about a mindset that can affect, if not completely hijack, any Christian disciple, the novice believer, that leader in the student Christian group, that church minister who got tired of reading and studying the Bible. My own staff colleague, Paul Blackham, was invited by one of our English diocesan bishops to go and address a meeting of all his clergy in the diocese. And they were told in advance, bring a Bible. This is going to be a Bible study. Many had not brought Bibles there. And when the time then came after the study for open discussion, it became obvious, as Paul told us on the staff, that there was a clear dividing line in that hall between the believers among those clergy who welcomed and responded to the Bible study and those others who publicly repudiated what they'd been hearing, some of them actually standing up and shaking with outraged indignation. As they said, this is an offense. That's clergy. Some clergy. What brings unbelief out into the open, where we can see it in its real, true colors? Why, it's the message and the manifested presence of Jesus Christ. The contrast in this passage of Mark 9 is sensational. From the Transfiguration mountaintop earlier on in the chapter to the valley, that vision of brilliant kingdom glory down to the bickering mediocrity of the crowd below in verse 14. From the holy, wonderful scene with Moses and Elijah in conversation with the irradiated Christ in millennial majesty down to the arid academics of the teachers of the law in confrontation with Christ's disciples who themselves were helpless in the face of a demon-possessed boy and his anguished father in all the dirt and the fallenness of the devil's territory. It's true that by the end of the drama, there in verse 24, the boy's father has his flickering faith fanned into flame. But the whole account from start to finish has to do with combating unbelief. Oh, unbelieving generation, are the words of the Lord. This particular piece of education in belief had been going on since Mark chapter 8, verse 31, just after Peter's great declaration that Jesus was the Messiah. And there we read that Jesus then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer and be rejected and killed, and after 3 days be raised again. The disciples weren't quick or happy to take this in, least of all Peter. Then the transfiguration takes place, where Jesus is lit up in glory on the mountaintop, followed by this event down in the valley. And then at Mark 9, verse 31, we read once more, Jesus was quote, teaching his disciples. What about? Same teaching. That the Son of Man would be put to death and would rise again. And still they couldn't take it in. And then yet again, Mark 10, verses 33 and 34. Same teaching. Son of Man is going to be betrayed. He'll be put to death. He'll rise again. So Mark 8, 31, Mark 9, 31, Mark 10, 33 and 34. Same teaching. Along the road, he's warning them, helping them to try and get the mindset straight on this. This account then of the demon-possessed boy is a sort of interlude within all this teaching. Its importance is that it highlights very dramatically the issue of belief and unbelief. That's what it does. Let's take it briefly in several stages. First, there's what I call down the mountain. Unbelief as we see it coming down the mountain. I look at Mark 9 verse 19. As they were coming down the mountain, we read, Jesus instructs them to keep quiet about the transfiguration that had just taken place until, it says, the Son of Man had risen from the dead. It goes on in verse 10. They kept this matter to themselves, discussing what rising from the dead meant. Because, of course, it was inconceivable to them that the Son of Man, the Messiah, could possibly be ignominiously killed in the first place. They'd been told earlier that it would happen, but they just weren't going to take it in. There may be a Muslim friend listening to me. In your own book, the Quran, you revere Jesus, not as the Messiah, or Son of God, but as a great prophet, and to you also it is inconceivable that such a leader would go to such a death. Yours is the same mindset as that of those friends of Jesus who at that stage couldn't take in what he was predicting would happen. When by God's grace, you Muslim, or somebody else who can't understand the cross, can't take it in, when you do take it in by God's grace, my friend, it'll change your life. Or rather, he will, the once crucified and now ever living master of the world. Peter, James and John, in verse 11, raise the question there of Elijah, given that they'd just seen Elijah on the mountaintop, so they're asking questions about him. And Jesus makes one point only in verses 12 and 13, that the Son of Man, whom the Elijah-like figure of John the Baptist had announced, he was the forerunner of Jesus, why John the Baptist would suffer the same fate, and so would the Son of Man. Jesus would suffer the same fate as that of John the Baptist. Again, the cross. He brings them back again to the cross. The teaching goes on. But the unbelief continues to manifest itself as they come down the mountain. Secondly now, we see unbelief right there at the bottom. Two, in the crowd. Now we're down from the mountain and we're into the crowd, as we term it. At last they've descended, and Peter, James and John rejoin the other nine disciples in verse 14, who are in the thick of an argumentative crowd. Dominating everything are the teachers of the law, the scribes. What's it all about? Jesus asks. One man answers, it's the father of a demon-possessed boy. Verse 18, I asked your disciples to drive out the spirit, but they could not. They could not. Some of you listening who are from cultures that have not traditionally been Christian may know a little bit more about demon possession than many others of us, living as we do in a country where the gospel has had a strong hold for many centuries, though we are seeing more of it now in Europe, where there seems to be such an effort to kick biblical Christianity out of the window. There are four main categories, actually, of activity associated with the unseen world of evil. First, there's superstition, plain and simple. Secondly, there's fortune-telling in about 30 different forms including use of pendulum, divining rod, astrology, card reading, and so on. Thirdly, there's magic, the attempt to bend unseen forces to achieve a desired result. And it occurs in some 18 different forms, including healing magic. Always it is to be condemned. And fourthly, there's spiritism. Spiritualism being its religious form. Spiritism is found in some 30 different guises: table lifting, glass moving, speaking in trance, automatic writing, materialization, levitation, and the occupation of an object or a house, or as here in Mark 9, a person taken over by an evil spirit. It's not so common in Britain as it is sometimes held. Sometimes those emotionally upset will imagine that they've become demon-possessed. But the very fear that you might be demon-possessed is a pretty strong indicator that you're not. After the showing of the film, The Exorcist, in London, a Christian psychiatrist had 30 or more people coming to him who had been disturbed by the film and feared that they had been taken over by an evil spirit and were now demon-possessed. All 30 people he put onto a course of little blue tablets. And within 2 weeks, all 30 were completely recovered. But blue tablets, were not going to help the boy here in Mark 9. Unfortunately, neither were those 9 disciples who had stayed at the foot of the mountain. They weren't going to help him either. That phrase at the end of verse 18 spells it out flatly. They could not, says the man. Why? After all, back in chapter 6 of Mark, verse 12, they'd been sent out 2 by 2, and we read that they drove out many demons. Why the change? To try again. Failure. Hence the crowd. Hence the argumentation. The scribes. Not that they, the scribes, could do anything to help the boy. They weren't helping him. Arguing was about the only thing they were good at. It only takes one failure and bam, the critics are onto you like a swarm of locusts. They could not. And it's that statement by the anxious father that provokes our key sentence of the story, verse 19. Oh, unbelieving generation, Jesus replied, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me. So the problem has to do with active belief, faith in Jesus, faith in Him. That's what it's on about. Kurt Koch, the German Lutheran pastor, who has written extensively on occult problems, often made the point that when helping somebody with a spiritual difficulty of this kind, first, it's vital that the counselor should not be a novice Christian, or somebody with an occult past. They shouldn't get involved in that either. And secondly, that they must be in a right and close relationship with our Lord Jesus Christ if they're going to undertake work of this kind at all. The relationship with Him is the important thing. It emerges in this passage that this was the problem. Christ is the answer to the unseen satanic world. And somehow those 9 disciples seem to have forgotten it and were trading on that memory of past victories in His name back in chapter 6. So in their helplessness and confusion and their inability to do anything to help this demon-possessed boy, the crowd gathers and the scribes weigh in with zest. But there's no doubt about it. The moment Jesus appears with the 3, at the foot of the mountain, there is instant recognition that this is the man with the power and with the answers. And so, in verse 15, as he comes into view, we see that everyone starts running towards him. They knew. They always knew. Rabindranath Maharaj, who was a young guru in India, a man who was accepting the worship and the gifts of many devotees, was once told by his mother, "Remember, Rabbi," she said, "there is one very specially powerful God called Jesus. And if ever you get into real trouble, you go running to him. He'll help." Well, that strange advice always stuck in Rabbi's mind, and it was part of a long, long chain of events that led him to a faith ultimately in Jesus Christ as the only true God. And he became a worshipper of him. Instead of being worshipped, he then worshipped the true God. And he became an evangelist. And his book, Death of a Guru, is on the All Souls Church bookstore at the present time. I remember meeting him at Amsterdam. As with him, so here in this crowd of Mark 9, they know, and they come running. But Jesus, all through this story, is dealing with unbelief. First, down the mountain. Secondly, in the crowd, where all the consternation and the controversy is going on. Thirdly, face to face. I come to the end of verse 18. Bring the boy to me. We have to do the same in our own day. If not physically, then by our prayers and intercessions. We bring people in our prayers to Jesus Christ, knowing that he is the one who can deal with all human problems, all spiritual difficulties. He is the one who can deal with them. He can help. And so we bring our friends to Jesus in our prayers. Do you have a prayer list? Do you add names of people for whom you have a concern to the regular printed church prayer diary? The Americans are good at this, I note. You mention a prayer concern to an American, and as often as not, they'll bring out a little book and a ballpoint, and they will put it down. We will remember. Bring him, bring her to me. That's what Jesus says. And we can do no better than that with friends and relatives and work colleagues. Yes, and enemies of Jesus as well. Of course we love the enemies of Jesus, because we see them in our prayers as no longer enemies, but as potential fellow disciples whom we want to win. Of course we love our enemies. That's why we love them. Jesus tells us to, and he wants them to become his friends too. And so they bring the boy in verse 20 to Jesus. And as always happens, when the occult world is challenged by his authority, there's a reaction. It's been so through all through Mark's gospel. Christ is establishing this great bridgehead against the powers of evil as he comes. And as he does so, coming into the gospels, the underworld reacts violently at times. It's a recognition of who is master. Circumvulsion takes place in the life of this boy. No, it's not the condition we know as epilepsy, which is recognized elsewhere in the Gospels as coming under an altogether different category. This, in verse 20, is a spiritual reaction. And any parent would identify warmly with the father in the story. The words at the end of verse 21, "If you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." Yeah. The problem was that the disciples had already muddied the water by their failure. They could not. So the father remembers this, and so he said, if you can. It's only a last despairing throw by the man, if you can. And the Lord builds on that tenuous, shaky opening. Verse 23, "If you can," he repeats, "everything is possible for him who believes." Is Jesus there implying that you can have everything if you believe? No, he's not. To think like that is too close to New Age teachers who say that you can have a God, you have a God inside you, they say, and there's nothing you can't do or have. I mean, if you've ever received teaching like that, maybe you're some business executive, and you've been to executives' seminars with the New Age teaching, they say, you've got a God in you. Nothing you can't do. It doesn't take 6 months for you to realize that there is not a God in you, and you're not God. Once you find you've got duodenal ulcers and missed assignments and a spouse, problems there and things in the family, it doesn't take long. It only takes 6 months and you realize, oh, no, it's not true at all. Then it's also too close to making faith, so-called, into a form of merit. So, you know, you can have anything if you believe. It's not quite that. Because otherwise you were in danger of making faith a sort of merit activity by which we can earn God's favor, a work. Not at all. Christ's words mean, as David Jackman once helpfully put it, that someone who has faith won't set any limit on what God can do. That's it. We ask of him in a prayer of faith, trusting him in the end to do as he will. So faith is God-centered, not me-centered. If we have real faith, nothing is impossible to God, and the way to express our faith is in prayer. Verse 24 is so human. I do believe, says the man. Help me overcome my unbelief. Well, that's us too. It's wobbly faith. It's tremulous faith. As shaky as the woman with the hemorrhage in the story, whose faith wouldn't stretch to more than just touching Jesus' clothes, let alone speaking to him. But Jesus honors the Father just as he hears and honors the prayers of the weakest person sharing in this sermon. And on saying this, I dare say that most of us, including myself, say, that's me. I am weak, but thou art strong. I am feeble in my faith. I am feeble in my prayers. But you are strong, and I want to be educated. Verse 25 brings us to the turning point. He's drawn the boy on one side now, Jesus has, which is always his way. You know, public exorcisms and public healings where you need an audience and props, a stage, special lighting and music are not the way of Jesus of Nazareth. But of course the crowd starts running again as the boy is freed. He looks like a corpse at first. They think he's dead, but Jesus lifts him to his feet. He's restored. This is a story of battling with unbelief down the mountain, in the crowd, and here with the boy and his father face to face. Help my unbelief. Fourthly, at the debrief, let me call it. The debrief. Because there's a conclusion, there's an aftermath. Have a look at verses 28 and 29. Yes, it's the aftermath, and the disciples are with Jesus, indoors, alone with him. It's wonderful. But verse 18, we realize it still rankles. They still remember what happened in verse 18. They could not. They could not. And they remember the Father's plea, if you can. Now they ask at the debrief, why couldn't we? How honest. They could not. If you can, why couldn't we? And Jesus answers them straight. This kind, he says, when you're facing a center of such evil in somebody's life, it can only come out by prayer. Oh, I know that some of the later, less reliable manuscripts of the scriptures add the words prayer and fasting. But let's remember, there was no time to fast in a crisis occasion like this. No, and those later manuscripts were probably the result of editors who had got into a tradition of seeing fasting as a way of proving holiness, almost as a kind of action of merit. The word fasting, legitimate in certain contexts, of course, doesn't actually belong here. Prayer, says Jesus. That's the secret. His words imply that they had not prayed on this occasion. And prayer is equivalent to faith. If you believe, you pray. If you pray, it is evidence that we are believers and believing. Yes, back in Mark 6, when they were confronting demons for the first time, of course they prayed. They were up against the unknown. They prayed. The tendency sometimes, when things have gone well, is then to become a professional. Remember Moses striking the rock or speaking to the rock the first time, water gushed out. Comes a second time, and by then he's impatient and cross with the people. He says, "Must we obtain water for you?" Hits the rock in a rage. He's become a professional. He became condemned for it. Here in Mark 9, they hadn't prayed. They thought, well, this is a rerun. Oh yeah, we know the ropes about exorcism. We know what to do, of course. That's fine. They find it wasn't going to be of any use. And here in the 21st century, I don't know that we, with the cross and resurrection behind us, with the advantage of the ascension and the gift of the Spirit at Pentecost, and the complete Bible, and the Reformation to look back to, and with all the history of revivals across history, I don't know that we have advanced noticeably from the days of those disciples. So let their debriefing with Jesus be our seminar too now. The great evangelist Gypsy Smith once said in a sermon, "In the model church, the people will love to pray. They will love that more than anything else. They would rather go to a prayer meeting than to a place of entertainment. When the Church of God uses the apostolic standard," said Gypsy Smith, "it will be a praying church. That will be its chief characteristic. These people prayed." In that fellowship group, at that next prayer gathering, in the student planning, there should be then a great spirit of expectation as we gather together. These people prayed. Prayer is opening the door of need to God. It's His way of our cooperating with His divine will and how it's going to be achieved in the world. We pray, He works. That's His appointed way. It's the way of faith. If there's no prayer, there's no faith. And we deserve His condemnation, O faithless generation, unbelieving generation. Have we finished? Just about. The issue here is unbelief. Down the mountain, in the crowd, face to face, and then also at the debrief. They had to learn the lesson. The only remaining and fifth facet of this issue we need to deal with only in a sentence or two is what I call fifthly and lastly, on the road again. Verses 30 and 32 finish off the episode. Yes, they've had that great encounter with the crowd and with the demon-possessed boy. Now they're on the road once more. And verse 31 says it, because he was teaching his disciples. What does he say to them? Mark 9, verse 31. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him, and after 3 days he will rise. But they did not understand what he meant and were afraid to ask him about it. So they're still not there yet. They're even afraid to ask Jesus what this is all about regarding the impending death of the Son of Man. The cross is coming ever closer, and they can't take it in. No, they won't take it in. The cross is a way of life. That's what the following passage in Mark 9 would tell us. Unless people do take it in, how can they ever be disciples of the Son of Man? Take it in. All these chapters have been emphasizing, take it in, lest we in our own time have to be condemned as a prayerless unbelieving generation.